We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 18, The Problem with House Elves. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Christine Schott about the problem with house elves. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, Instructor of Comparative Religions and Cultural Competency at Mount Carmel College, and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Emily! We are talking today about how the house elf problem reveals a lot of important considerations for the world we live in today. And you and yes. I both, we are on this. We both love the house elves.
I'm here for the house elves.
Absolutely. Yeah. But this made me wonder, when you're reading fantasy fiction like Harry Potter, are you thinking about how it relates to the real world, or are you fully subsumed into the fantasy universe?
Oh, I think I would have to say definitely on my first read, I'm pretty well subsumed, you know, if the writing encourages that. And Harry Potter always does. But then, you know, when I go back and reread, I think that's probably more when my brain is kind of firing all those little connections and saying, and sometimes, you know, I honestly don't catch a lot of things. And then in talking with other people and hearing their reactions to the reading, that's, for me, that's where the magic happens. And my brain really starts exploding with all these connections. What about you?
Yes. Well, we're big fans of rereading, of course. Yeah. And I think that too, I do tend to be pulled away by the series and I'm really in the moment. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, as you're sort of, especially if you're, you know, parsing it out, which I always like to do with the Harry Potter stories, like don't read too many chapters in a row so that you can enjoy it, savor it.
Right.
And then, you know, when you're thinking about it later in the, you know, and you're like, oh, I have this good book to go back to. That's right. When I start to make those connections, you know, when I'm not actually reading it, but I am thinking about it. And so that happened to me with the house elves, actually, where I was, you know, I was teaching a class, a feminism class and history of feminism. And I was, you know, listening to, must have been book 4 and doing the dishes or something. And I was like,
something domestic.
Huh. You know, and you make those little connections.
Yeah.
Which I think are what's really, I think that's what really does keep these stories alive, you know.
And Katie, I have to say, your essay on house elves, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, your essay on house elves as sort of a metaphor for housewives is like 100% of the reason why in my household, if, you know, the domestic work is piling up on one person, and that person is usually me, I will start to make protests that sound like, there are no house elves that live here, or I am not your house elf. That's when I'm particularly
Uh-oh.
Irked, you know? Yeah. So thank you for that contribution to our household rhetoric.
Happy to help. Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's funny. Well, to help us make these connections today, Emily and I are joined by Dr. Christine Schott. Dr. Schott is Associate Professor of English at Erskine College in my home state of South Carolina. She has degrees from Dartmouth College, University of Virginia, Converse College, and the University of Iceland. Very cool. And teaches and publishes on a variety of topics, including medieval literature, Icelandic literature, and young adult literature. The article of hers we're going to focus on today is one of Emily's and my favorite topics, and it's entitled The House Elf Problem, Why Harry Potter is more relevant now than ever from the Midwest Quarterly's Winter 2020 issue. So very topical. And Emily and I are ready to go with this one. Welcome to the show, Christine.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, Christine, that when we were talking, and I think that this is actually on one of our episodes, we were talking with our producer, Lori Beckoff, and she said, she was like, I think there's this great house elf essay that I think is like the best, you know, response to why Harry Potter, why now? And so she had turned us to your essay, and we're so glad to have you on the show.
Oh, wow. I feel honored.
Yeah. And Lori is very discerning.
Oh, yes. Yes. A compliment from Lori really means something.
Absolutely. So, Christine, tell us, how did you first discover the Harry Potter books and what led you to take them seriously as literature?
Well, I think I was about halfway through high school, and my sister, who's 5 years younger than me, was just exactly the target age as the books were coming out. And she had read the first three of them and loved them. And I think she sort of imposed them upon my mother, and who then imposed them upon me. And I think I read them in like a weekend, all of the first three together. I'm not sure I ever didn't take them seriously as literature. It's something that even as a teenager, I couldn't turn off. I think I was destined to end up in graduate school for literature. But I think in particular with these books, I kind of read the first one. I had no spoilers at all. I read the first one and was just waiting for Snape to be the bad guy. And when I got to the end and it was Quirrell of all people, I think that's when I realized, I think there's something to these books. And it, of course, they get more and more complex as you go on, but I was with them with that mentality that these are more complex than you expect them to be kind of from the very beginning.
You know what, Christine, I had that exact experience where I was like, oh, this is a fun children's book. And then it was Quirrell. And I was like, oh, this is something more. And yeah, I had that same feeling at that same moment. You know, I think it's what you described there as sort of chain of people saying, these are good until they get to you. I think a lot of people have that experience too. So your article, The House Elf Problem, Why Harry Potter is More Relevant Now Than Ever, came out in the winter 2020 issue of Midwest Quarterly. So tell us, why is Harry Potter even more relevant now in this second decade of the 21st century?
Well, I think especially with young people now, and of course that is my focus as a college professor, young people now I think are more aware than maybe any generation previous of how faulty our world is, how much injustice exists in our world. And I think young people especially are sort of left going, well, how do I respond to that? What am I supposed to do? And I think books are a really good, you could either think of them as a training ground or a playground for trying out ways to respond to problems. And the Harry Potter books, I think, are particularly good for that because they are so complex. They bring up so many issues that touch on real world things. I mean, I think this is the power of fantasy and sci-fi, is that they always function sort of metaphorically. I mean, what does magic represent? Is it economic power? Is it racial power? What kind of power is involved? And that makes us excited when we get to use books as a way of thinking about real world issues. And I think we get to see it along with Harry Potter. I mean, in the first book, he discovers a world that is wonderful and magical, and he falls in love with it, the world of Hogwarts and the wizarding world. And then we grow with him as he discovers through the following six books that the world that he loves and the people that he loves are not as unambiguously good as he thought they were. And he's left with trying to deal with that. And I think we get to kind of deal with that along with him.
True.
What a great really point. True. I mean, I think also like the nature of that, the like the portal fantasy where you think, oh, I'm going out of my really sucky life. Right. And I'm going into this world where I am a wizard and things are magical. And here are these good people. And then to realize that, oh, these same kind of problems, they exist everywhere. And that's kind of a, you know, that's kind of an experience, I guess, of childhood and adolescence growing up that I think resonates.
Yeah. I liked what you said about books as a training ground or a playground. And I honestly think that they can be both simultaneously. I mean, mm-hmm. this is, you know, when we talk about Quidditch, you know, it's both mm-hmm. for the characters, and it's both in that tradition of the school story. Sport is both, you know, a training ground and a playground for the characters, and Rowling certainly uses it that way. So yeah, and in that sense, it works on the level of metaphor for books themselves.
And, you know, I think about all the protests, you know, where people have signs that are literally referencing the novels that young adults have been reading for the last mm-hmm. 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. So they're taking those allegories, or they're taking those metaphors out with them.
Christine, Katie and I probably don't even need an explanation of why you became interested in house elves, because, you know, to us, their interest is obvious.
Oh, yes.
But for our listeners, I should say, tell us when you first got interested in house elves in particular, as an important dimension of the series.
I think it may be after Dobby is freed and we start to meet other house elves. If we just had Dobby, it would be such an unambiguous situation where it's like mm-hmm. house elf slavery is bad and Dobby wants to be free and he should be free. But then we get Winky and we get Creature and we get these other characters not responding as we expect them to the very idea of house elf slavery. And I think the very fact that it is so dissatisfying as a plot line that mm-hmm. It's left unresolved, you know, by the end of the story, we're not even certain whether Winky participates in the Battle of Hogwarts. You know, Rowling has said later that she did, but we don't see her in the book participating. And we're not exactly sure how we feel about Creature participating in the Battle of Hogwarts specifically for Harry and mm-hmm. not because he opposes Voldemort, you know, the great evil of the series. So it's so dissatisfying for a reader. And I think moments like that in literature are actually really valuable, because it's almost like a little splinter you end up working out, and you spend so much time thinking about it. And I think that thinking is one of those exercises that, well, they strengthen our sort of reasoning abilities. And as we try to work that splinter of dissatisfaction out, I think we produce interesting things, interesting thoughts.
I love that metaphor, Christine. That's just perfect. And it was one, yeah, it's like a little problem. And you're like, wait a minute, how am I supposed to deal with Winky, or, you know, what's happening here with all the butterbeer and all of that. So one of the things that you talk about in your article is that there's this ambivalence, especially about the house elves. What is ambivalent about her depiction of their condition? And then, you know, what are we supposed to do about that?
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think what's so ambivalent about them is that for the most part, except for Dobby, they're happy being enslaved. Like, who writes mm-hmm. something like that? And I know that, you know, kind of if we put it in the context of folklore and mythology, they've been compared to brownies or farfadet, mm-hmm. the French equivalent. I recognize that. And there's probably some level on which people are perfectly content to read them that way. I mean, that's how Ron and Harry and Hagrid respond to them, is that that's part of their nature. They are servile by nature and they're happy. And so we leave them alone and we let them do what apparently genetically they're programmed to want to do. And yet for people who are not coming at it from that mythological or folkloric standpoint, they look problematically like a lot of other things. You know, mm-hmm. especially for Americans, you start talking about chattel slavery, I think it's impossible for us not to think about sort of the minstrel stereotype of the happy slave. Mm-hmm. Katie, you've talked about them as, you know, the happy housewife. Emily, you've talked about them as sort of living robots who in sci-fi always demand that we ask questions about what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be sentient? So these characters are sort of almost like open containers for concerns that we have. And because they can mean so many different things, it's really hard just to leave them alone. There's something that demands a response from us.
And they don't behave the way you would want them to. And I was thinking about what you said about, you know, if it's just Dobby, Like, that's the way we want the story to go, mm-hmm. right? Oh, mm-hmm. good. He's been liberated. And, you know, maybe this is the first step for how self-liberation, but that's not how she continues their story.
Right.
And what an interesting decision. I love that you were like, who writes this? Right. Who suggests this? And Emily, I could hear you laughing in the background there. Yeah.
Right. And like, there are, who indeed?
Yeah. And, you know, and I think that there are a lot of fans who that was their response. It's like, Rowling has made a huge mistake here. And in fact, there's been a lot of criticism, this mm-hmm. idea of happy slaves. And when I was, you know, trying to work it out myself, you know, I guess in the American context, it's very hard to talk about this in terms of race and African-American enslavement. Because of this idea that, you know, there would be the suggestion that there might be people who were happy in their enslavement. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I sort of moved it over to one of those other, you know, boxes that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. So that, because feminists have dealt with this pretty squarely as well, although African-American historians and thinkers, philosophers have talked about it too. But I was teaching feminism, so it was in my mind, but I, you know, this idea of people who find freedom difficult and seem resistant to it at some level. And I thought, you know, feminist theory does address it. And so I could talk about it that way. But mm-hmm. I think, you know, this idea of not only race and gender, but also class, which I think is what Emily is sort of getting at with these robot servants, mm-hmm. that somehow the house elves are at the crux of all of those. And can represent all of them. And the reality in the world that we live in today is we have not fixed this problem.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We haven't right. fixed any of these problems of, you know, racial discrimination and marginalization and, you know, gender and sex discrimination and class oppression and all of those things. They're just still with us. And somehow they seem almost intractable. And Rowling is displaying that. So, you know, mm-hmm. when we think about how do we deal with the fact that we haven't, you know, resolved these problems that remain ambivalent for us as well as for the, you know, for the books, you know, what are we supposed to do with that? I mean, as we're working it out, I think the ideas that are presented for solutions in the Harry Potter books are maybe not that great.
Yeah.
You, not that yeah. awesome.
Yeah. And you deal with that really well in your essay, Christine. For me, you know, thinking about them as you said, the happy slave, the one that's sort of like this is in their nature to serve. And so, of course, they're happy doing that. That mm-hmm. that was the very notion about them that made me think of them as robots in science fiction stories, in classic science fiction stories. But at the same time, in those same stories, it's never a clean cut portrayal of robots. Mm-hmm. You know, there are in the stories that I looked at, there are. It's a definite, distinct subplot that the treatment of these created servants is problematic on a lot of levels. Star Wars deals with it by having the good characters treat their droids well and the bad characters treat their droids poorly, hmm. you know, and so that communicates something. And so house elves really do sort of push that envelope. And I think, in you know, we keep asking who indeed would write this, but you know, maybe in the author's defense, I don't know. She gives us Dobby first, you know, this mm-hmm. is our first mm-hmm. exposure to this issue, you know? And so we get this model example. And one of my favorite things about Dobby, and this is something also that plays out in robot stories, is there is an underlying fear of the robots as having the potential to become more powerful than the humans and to mm-hmm. exert some control over the humans in that sense. And with house elves, I really loved as Dobby's character developed into book 7, you know, that we get a sense that the house elves have magic that the wizards not only don't understand, but can't access, certainly. Mm-hmm. And this allows Dobby to break into Malfoy Manor and to rescue the trio, spoiler alert, when they're trapped there with very little hope of any other kind of rescue. And so this very underestimated character mm-hmm. breaks in and does this, and it ends up being, you know, a self-sacrifice mm-hmm. that he effects because, you know, obviously Bellatrix stabs him as they're as they're disapparating.
Mm-hmm. But I was going to say too, like, remember that, like, the statement that he makes right before that is that very mm-hmm. powerful. Dobby has no master. Dobby is a free elf.
Right.
And that like freedom to then sacrifice, that combination, I think is tough.
Yeah, it is tough. And as you said in your essay, Christine, it could be kind of problematically perceived. So how mm-hmm. should we understand the sacrifice of house elves like Dobby, maybe even like Creature, in the eventual battle against Voldemort? What are the complexities to be aware of? Like, for instance, how should we understand Harry's hope that Creature might bring him a sandwich when the battle is over? Is it okay for us to be okay with that?
I always thought that was the most disappointing last line.
Yes.
It's the last thing we get before the epilogue. But yeah, as you brought up, the self-sacrificing subordinate is a trope, right? And mm-hmm. whether that subordinate who sacrifices themselves is a slave or a servant or a wife, I mean, that comes up all the time, or a robot. I mean, I love Star Wars, but my sci-fi is Star Trek Next Generation. And, you know, Data sacrifices himself for the Enterprise.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, the trope of the self-sacrificing subordinate just happens all the time. And it is problematic and can be problematic when that's just sort of the assumption that that's what they're there for, is to sacrifice himself for the hero. But I also think that not all tropes operate the same way within the narrative context. And I think it's really important for us to recognize that, because practically at this point, everything's a trope. And when we look at it in the larger context of Harry Potter, the entire series is built on the importance of self-sacrifice, that is the greatest heroism. Lily, Harry, Snape, and Dobby all sacrifice themselves for others.
And right, so, Dumbledore too.
And Dumbledore too. If the self-sacrificing subordinate falls into that trope, it also elevates Dobby to the level of the greatest heroes of the story. And of course, you know, in a kind of even greater context, the idea of self-sacrifice as being sort of the greatest form of love and heroism comes out of a Christian narrative. And so really Dobby becomes sort of a type of Christ, mm-hmm. which, I mean, can't get too much better than that, right?
Right, especially for Christians.
Yeah, and what do you think about this line with the sandwich? You know, with Creature and Harry not really. I mean, Creature hasn't really been elevated to that level. Yeah. What should we do with that?
I loved how you pointed out, it is kind of like, he says it nicely. It's like he wonders whether Creature would, you know, like it sets up the way he might even be asking Creature, which is as a favor, you know, not as a demand.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's how we're supposed to take it, right? Is that Harry has learned not to boss people around, even if they're house elves. And I think that's supposed to be kind of a positive sense for him that maybe he's making some progress in the direction Hermione would like him to make. And it has been pointed out that Harry tends to think on in terms of the individual, just actually like Creature does. He's loyal to the wizards who are good to him and betrays the ones who are mean to him, regardless of what side they're on. And Harry kind of thinks in those terms too, like Dobby wants to be free, so he makes sure Dobby goes free. He's not interested in freeing Winky, for instance, because Winky clearly goes to pieces when she's freed. So he thinks in terms of individuals, not systemically. He's not interested in kind of these larger sweeping changes that Hermione's interested in. And so the fact that instead of ordering Creature to bring him a sandwich, he hopes the Creature might consider bringing him a sandwich, I think is supposed to be positive change. But he also seems to have forgotten that Creature was just fighting in the battle for Hogwarts, just like everybody else. He's not thinking of asking Hermione to go get him a sandwich. So he's still got some limitations.
There would be something wrong with
that. Hermione would be like, you get your own sandwich. Can you imagine what would Hermione's reaction be? That's hilarious.
Oh my gosh. And you know what? It's funny because this distinction between how the favor is asked, whether it's demanded or whether it's, you know, asked for nicely, mm-hmm. is like one of the triggering factors for me to turn to my family members and say, I am not your house elf. So when they make the demand rather than asking nicely with manners. So mm-hmm. it's all relevant on a practical
difference.
Level for me.
Yeah. So this does bring us to this question of, okay, so if we're reading this and we're thinking about how does this inform us about how to achieve social change. You know, you've got Harry, who's very individual focused. You've got Hermione, who's more aware of systems and the oppressive systems that exist in the wizarding world. What are the lessons for social change activists today, particularly in, you know, these attempts at house elf liberation? And particularly, how can we understand Hermione's abolitionism in the context of being anti-racist today?
Yeah, I think this is why I ended up having to write an article about this subject. I couldn't easily resolve what was going on here, because on some level, Hermione's got the right idea, right? Slavery should not exist. This should be abolished. But at the same time, what she's doing is intervening as a person who is in power. She's intervening on behalf of people who don't have an enormous amount of power, the house elves, but she's not taking into account what they want at all. And right. She's coming in, sweeping in, saying, I know what's best for you. And isn't that a little disrespectful? So it's not an easy thing to resolve, but I think there are a couple of details within the story that do kind of teach us a lesson about that. For instance, the fact that she's knitting these hats that she hides and hopes that the house elves cleaning Gryffindor Tower will accidentally free themselves. The fact that we discover Dobby's the only one now cleaning Gryffindor Tower because all the other house elves have cottoned on to the fact that she is trying to free them and they don't want to be tricked into this, that she actually makes more work for one of the very people she's trying to help, Dobby, by trying to intervene in this way without taking into account what the people that she's trying to help would prefer. I think that's an important lesson for people who do want to help. And I think allies in, you know, the various struggles for social justice now in comparison to, you know, 20, 30 years ago, I think we're becoming more aware of how important bottom-up change is, that, you know, to come in from the outside and say, I know what's best for you, is both disrespectful and also maybe not the most productive way of going about seeking social change. And Hermione is also very naive. Like, it's very well intended, but it's also very naive because she doesn't take into account the fact that, you know, once Dobby's freed, he spends, 2 years wandering around England unemployed. So a free house elf in this context where the rest of culture hasn't changed, a free house elf is a hungry house elf. And the only place he can find employment is at Hogwarts. So she is thinking systemically, but in a very narrow way. And she's not thinking about the fact that if you just end house elf slavery now, that's not solving the problem, because then what happens to the house elves? So she's got her heart in the right place. She might be moving in the right direction, but like so many, especially young people who want to get involved, she hasn't really figured out how best to address that issue.
Right.
Yeah. And she doesn't even really know much about house elves, right? She knows enough to know that there's this big injustice, but she needed to maybe spend more time understanding the issue. But then you look at people who do understand it, like Dumbledore. And, you know, as you pointed out, like, Dumbledore's like a slave owner. Mm-hmm. And having Hogwarts filled with house elves doing all of this labor, and they don't get, you know, paid vacations, and, you know, they don't have sick leave and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's a real challenge, because the people who seem like they understand are not the ones trying actively to topple the system.
Yeah. Right. But I think it does kind of ask us to consider, well, what are other ways that Hermione or Dumbledore, who clearly doesn't approve of the very concept of house elf slavery, what are other ways they could have gone about this? And I think that intellectual exercise, that imaginative exercise, you know, she says they're brainwashed and uneducated. Well, what if they were educated? What if Dobby had a leadership role? And what's interesting is Dobby doesn't want a leadership role because he knows the dynamics involved. He's like, leave me out of this, when Hermione tries to use him as an example of like a happy freed house elf. The exercise of imagining how things might have gone better, I think, is very useful when we start to apply that to real world situations. How might we imagine other ways of solving a problem other than coming in and saying, I know how to fix this?
And I love how you called the house elves becoming aware of what Hermione's trying to do with the knitted hats as they're cottoning on. That was a really good pun.
Oh, man. Yeah.
You just slipped that one in there, Christine. I liked that. I liked that. It did not fall on deaf ears. Okay. Tell us more about your teaching on Harry Potter and how you've been able to use, you know, this aspect of the narrative that really asks challenging questions and doesn't tie them all up in a bow. How have you used that in the classroom and how have students responded?
It's been very interesting. So the very first time I taught a Harry Potter course, dedicated Harry Potter courses, 5 years ago. And in that class, I had all sorts of Potterheads. You know, they had been at this forever. They grew up with the books and they were delighted to talk about these issues because as fan studies scholars like Henry Jenkins, for instance, have mentioned, I mean, this is stuff that people talk about in the fandom already on their own time. And when you bring it into the classroom, like that's really exciting to them. And so the first time I taught this class, I had tons of discussion about these kind of big issues and how do we deal with these big, ambiguous, gray area kind of issues in the books and how do those apply to kind of a real life applications. And then I taught it most recently a year ago, and it was, this surprised me, a completely different population. Students who had maybe seen a couple of the movies, they were too young for most of the movies as they were coming out. Very few of them had read the books. And so they actually approached Harry Potter, oddly enough, as they would approach kind of any literature class, where they kind of expected that we were going to be talking about these issues, and they didn't have a very strong sense of like the sort of inviolability of the wizarding world, that like we couldn't have hard conversations about it because we didn't want to ruin it. They didn't have those assumptions at all. And I'm kind of feeling that there's sort of a bit of a sea change in how young people see Harry Potter, because we now have people in college who didn't grow up with it, and for whom encountering it in college might actually be the first time they've really thought about it in any kind of major way. So I think going forward, it might completely change how we deal with something like Harry Potter in a classroom, but I haven't figured that out yet.
Oh yeah. That's one of the things that I always think is interesting about teaching. You know, you get these generational changes that are very hard to predict. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And I've seen some similar things that you're talking about with Harry Potter, where there was a shift to the movies, where a lot of people had seen the movies, but they didn't read the books. And now, you know, a lot of them haven't even seen the movies. So that's interesting. And so they're maybe more prepared for the literary discussion as a result of that. That's fascinating, but maybe don't have the emotional connection that makes those discussions so exciting.
Right.
Exactly. That's why I'm not sure what will happen. So, you know, when I teach a class on Shakespeare, they might not like Shakespeare, but they know you're supposed to know about Shakespeare. You know, you're supposed to have conversations about Shakespeare. But if I bring in Harry Potter and they don't have any connection to Harry Potter, do they have a reason to want to have a serious discussion about Harry Potter? How embedded is Harry Potter going to remain in our culture going forward? I think that's the big question.
Yes, right. We think about that question all the time. Yes.
Yeah.
So I was interested in your article, you talked about how a student had raised the question of Hokey, the house elf, who seems like she's well-treated and her, you know, napkin or whatever that she's wearing is nicely pressed and clean. And she has a lot of loyalty with Hepzibah Smith, who's her mistress. And that the student kind of pointed out, well, you know, maybe it's not bad to be a house elf because Hokey portrays this counter example, and that this is the kind of classroom moment I love. And you were like, huh, right? Where you're like, okay, so that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. And I was wondering how how you've thought about that student's way of thinking about the house elves, particularly Hokey.
Yeah. And of course, in the moment, I think I just sort of stared at her and had no intelligent response at all.
That's one of my moves as well.
Classic teacher move. It made me think, and that's one of the things that I appreciate so much about teaching is when I get to learn from my students. And the fact that she had brought up this idea of the counter example a relationship that actually seems to be working fairly well. I mean, Hepzibah does order her around, but they seem to be sort of co-conspirators, you know, like Hoki's kind of involved. She's in on it. And then does that kind of make us question the sort of badness of the institution? And it made me think about the fact that in popular culture, especially more recently, the movies that we see about enslavement of especially African Americans, because that's kind of where my cultural context is, where we see that, we only see the sort of most horrific, violent, dehumanizing examples. And we don't see depictions of a relationship in which the enslaved person is not horribly abused, but might actually have a fairly decent standard of living. For instance, slaves who were within the house as opposed to field hands. And what alarmed me about that point that my student made was that the very idea that somebody might not horrifically abuse their slave might make it okay to have slaves. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh no, we need to kind of counteract this. And so I think having a balance, seeing other examples of what a relationship between a slave and their owner might look like, I think actually might be important to counteracting the sort of nostalgia that said, oh, well, the Old South, you know, things weren't so bad in the Old South. As long as people were good to their slaves, it was okay. No, it was not okay. Mm-hmm. And we right. see that, I think, even in the book where a creature is given a good order, a well-intentioned order by Regulus Black. He says, and destroy the locket. And that's a good thing, right? And he should destroy the locket, but he can't destroy the locket. And he has to punish himself as a result. And that surely leads to some of his sort of instability as a being, poor creature. And so I think Hermione says, don't you see how sick it is that they have to obey? And I think that's a really formative moment for us as readers, but also for Harry, because that's the first time he is very careful to be very polite to creature after that. And I think maybe it's just the glimmer of him starting to recognize that the whole system is rotten and that the whole system needs to be altered before any kind of justice can be enacted.
Yeah. And it's not just a matter of being nicer to your slaves.
Right.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's... Yeah. And Malcolm X talks about the house Negro, right? Mm-hmm. And this idea, not idea, but this reality of the servant. And of course, he's talking about African-American slaves or former slaves, you know, who become so deeply embedded with their masters, you know, or their employers, you know, later, that, you know, they become their collaborators in the injustice. But I was interested when I was reading that about how he calls them house Negroes, and it reminded me of the house elves. And you're right, this is it is difficult in that scenario of the Hoki scenario of when the servant is being treated well and is a valued member of the household. It's difficult to see how sick it is that they have to obey.
Yeah. And yet it doesn't mean it's not sick, you know.
Exactly.
That's the
exactly.
hard step that we have to make as readers.
Right. And you know, I struggled with this a lot when I was writing about the house elves too. And there is a political scientist named John Gaventa who writes actually about coal miners and talks about various forms of power. And he identifies a power dynamic in which the oppressed people actually identify with their oppressors and support their oppressors because they think it, because they've so internalized their oppression that they think that their fate is bound up in their oppressors also doing well. And boy, living in Appalachian, Ohio, I feel like I see that a lot, you know, in terms of the still like the coal mining culture that persists here. And then also like for feminism, this is like sleeping with the enemy, you know, and the idea that women saw themselves and their fates as bound up with the men who were in, you know, who were oppressing them, or, you know, that they were forced to obey in the sense of those vows. And with Hoki in particular, like I struggled with that one because I first wrote my house elves piece before Hoki had been introduced as a character and it worked. And then there's Hoki. And I was like, well, what do I do with Hoki? She's there for not very long. And what does she mean? And I sort of became troubled by the fact that she confessed to the murder of her mistress. Mm-hmm. and saw that as an outcome of her internalized obedience to the oppressive structure, that she would even confess to something that if she had a really strong sense of self, she would have known she would never do. I mean, Harry doesn't know her, and he knows that Hoki would never kill Hepzibah, but Hoki doesn't even know it for herself. And that shows you some of the sickness in the oppressive system as it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough dilemma, and how interesting that Rowling is able to bring us these challenges to our way of thinking. It's just not easy to get out of.
And I think that's part of the value of a story that doesn't give us easy answers. I mean, a story that gives us easy answers, eventually we stop reading, or it feels like propaganda. But when literature kind of puts the problem in our lap and says, well, what do you do with that? I think that's where it's at its most valuable.
Agree.
Now, your article also engages with the specter of what some call cancel culture. And, you know, that's something that's, boy, is that everywhere at this particular moment. How does this cancel culture, or whatever else, whatever other term we might use for it, how is it affecting both the way we read young adult literature like Harry Potter, and also what's even getting published today?
Yeah, it was funny. I was looking back at my article, and I think I defined cancel culture in the article as though nobody had ever heard of it. And I was like, wow, how the world has changed in a couple of years. I mean, I think cancel culture is a response to, or an action taken based on acknowledging the fact that words matter. And particularly when you are a celebrity with an enormous platform, that what you put on that platform and how you use that power matters, and that there can be consequences for that. It's only one way of responding to that kind of thing, of course. And I think right now it's particularly difficult for us because this is so sensitive, right? All of the issues right now are so sensitive. They're like open wounds. And it's really difficult for us to navigate around a conversation that has to do with when people say things that we find morally or ethically or humanely abhorrent. And we find it very difficult, especially to separate the personal life and opinions of an author, for instance, or a celebrity of any kind, from the text or the art that they create. We find that very, very difficult, particularly if the person's still alive. I think we can separate Shakespeare from Hamlet pretty easily, but it's much harder to separate Rowling from Harry Potter. And especially those of us who kind of grew up with Harry Potter as an important part of our lives are now stuck with, can we still like Harry if we're disappointed in some of the things that Rowling has used her platform to do?
Yeah.
And there is no easy answer to that. I'm not going to pretend that there is, but this is where, as a teacher, I always come back to the idea of books as that training ground or that playground for us to experiment with ways to respond. Specifically because with Harry Potter, he's also betrayed and disappointed by people like Dumbledore, who he finds out has a past that he is shocked by, and then finds out that Dumbledore basically set him up to die. And the narrative does a lot of sort of contortions to try to make that okay, you know, when he's discussing with Dumbledore in the sort of afterlife. The narrative does a lot of contortions to try to make it okay that Dumbledore did that. But I think deep down, we're like, no, it's really not okay that Dumbledore did that. And so, but does that taint what Dumbledore stood for, which was the fight against Voldemort and, you know, a better wizarding world? And I think ultimately Harry decides that what Dumbledore did does not taint the importance of what Dumbledore was fighting for in his better moments. And I think that's kind of an odd parallel with us, that whatever we feel about Rowling's tweeting habits or the tweeting habits of any of those celebrities, does that necessarily taint what they create, which we love for very different reasons? And so I think a lot of Harry Potter fans, they have had to kind of put aside their love for Harry Potter as a response, but that's not the only way to respond. And I think letting the books be a place where we can talk about how do you respond to people who disappoint us, I think can be a really powerful way of maintaining our love for the best parts of Harry Potter.
So true. So true. I like that. It's one of many ways of responding. And it's fine. And if people want to respond that way, it's totally up to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but these books, I mean, I agree. They give us good grounds for talking about even these kinds of issues, right? It's like we're reflective or something, but I love the parallel with Dumbledore there.
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I always think like I wish J.K. Rowling would read her books more carefully, right? So that she would learn from them some of the things that we learned, you know?
Right.
And so I think I like that idea that the books themselves, you know, can have some, not only answers, but like good talking points for us as we work through these splinters, as you call them.
Yeah. Well, and I, as someone who has, you know, who makes art on a regular basis, not everything you're doing is conscious, you know, not every, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of subconscious stuff that comes out in the art, and that, you know, I'll look later and look back on something I wrote 10 years ago and say, wow, yeah, I can really tell that this was happening there. But of course, I couldn't tell that at the time, you know. And so I think it's a particularly sensitive issue, the cancel culture thing, or the accountability culture, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. is sensitive for artists in particular, because, you know, we do think of our art as something that lives on, you know, despite us, you know, in spite mm-hmm. of us, not just because of us. And so, yeah, I appreciated your way of dealing with it. So, you also wrote a really interesting article for the Chronicle of Higher Education called How to Save Literary Studies. So what do you think, Christine? How do we save literary studies? How do we keep the discipline of literary studies alive on college campuses and elsewhere today?
Well, I mean, that's probably need another hour just to discuss that, right? But I do think that my experience of teaching Harry Potter, I think, does give me a bit of a way forward in that, in this kind of post-structuralist world that we live in, I don't come to Harry Potter and the reading of Harry Potter and the analysis of Harry Potter in any significantly different way than I come to Chaucer or Shakespeare. It is a text, a set of texts, that I'm going to analyze for, you know, their theme and maybe even their problematic elements. And there are certainly those in Chaucer as well as in Harry Potter. And I think teaching popular literature, we've often seen it as being a separate thing from teaching like canon literature, traditional literature, that it's mostly a study of sort of pop culture. It's a study of the context rather than the text itself. And I don't see it that way. My students wrote very literary, traditional literary analysis papers in my Harry Potter class. And I think those were skill building. They were getting the skills out of that class, which was to, you know, analyze literature, think hard about it, and communicate about it. They were getting the same thing out of that as they would have if they had taken a class in Chaucer with me. And even more than that, I like to think that what we do in a literature classroom has ripple effects in the world once the students leave the classroom and are living their ordinary lives. And I think sometimes, as a trained medievalist, I think sometimes about the fact that, you know, even with my English majors, probably the last time they will ever look at the Canterbury Tales is when I teach it in my class. And when they are 40 years old and in the middle of a career, how likely are they to crack the spine of their, you know, Norton anthology and just read The Wife of Bat's Tale? But they're going to
If you were going to read one though, Christine, if you were going to pick a Chaucer,
it's a good one.
Right?
Right?
It would be The Wife of Bat.
Yeah, but you know, but hopefully if they have, you know, enjoyed the literature that we talk about in class, hopefully they will keep reading. It just won't necessarily be Chaucer. They're going to read popular literature. They're going to read the stuff mm-hmm. that's coming out now. And I would like to see them apply those analytical, hard-thinking sorts of skills to Harry Potter and Hunger Games and whatever the kids are reading now. I don't know. Because I think that that's how their literary education is going to have an impact on their lives. They're going to apply it to the media that they consume out in the real world, in their natural environment. And I keep thinking about the fact that in book five, when Umbridge is teaching them defense against the dark arts, and it's only going to be theoretical. And somebody, Harry or Hermione, points out, you know, when someone's attacking us, it's not going to be theoretical. And she's keeps insisting, nobody's going to attack you. And of course, we know she's wrong. But I keep thinking, only Umbridge insists that school has nothing to do with real life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she clearly hasn't lived a year at Hogwarts, because somebody always gets attacked.
That's right.
Like nearly every chapter. Very dangerous place.
True enough. Yeah. And one of the other points of your article in the Chronicle that I really like, Christine, was when you said that, you know, as scholars, we really need to be making sure that we're able to communicate ideas clearly, and that we should be taking a more active public role. And I think about the whole, you know, the notion of the ivory tower and so on. And I think it's been, in some ways, that was supposed to be a statement of expertise, but it's actually been really detrimental to the walling off of educational experiences and, frankly, expertise. And I think that we are witnessing some of the problems with that as it is now, you know, that people feel as though experts are just making stuff up because they don't understand the way that people are talking. And that, you know, your point is, let's become good communicators, and let's not just try to talk to the, you were talking like to the two other people who study Icelandic marginalia, you know,
literally two.
But let's, you know, let's try to talk to everyone. I know Emily and I, this is one of our major points. Like, this is
our jam.
This is the podcast, you know, this is why we do this, because there are lots of people out there who they are looking for analysis and things that, you know, make them think and think about their lives in the world in a better way. But, you know, they don't need it to be Homi Bhabha, you know. they don't want to wade through that kind of language and, you know, that level of abstraction. And so often I think that we, you know, we fall into that vocabulary when we would actually do our fields, you know, many favors by being more approachable.
Accessible. Yes. Accessible. Yeah. I mean, words are where the interior meets the exterior. And so they do have to be, I mean, and, you know, so you can choose the way your interior meets the exterior, you know, and if you want that to be in a way that really pigeonholes you as only speaking to an erudite audience, you know, I mean, I think some people do want that, you know, and some people find value in that. But is that the way to carry literary studies into modern life, you know, for people like your students? You know, if we think it matters that they get these degrees and we require them to take these humanities classes, you know, then shouldn't we be concerned that they have the ability to carry that into the future and to be able to articulate these hard themes and these hard questions and their own responses to them, you know, in life 10 years later when they pick up a, I don't know, a Grisham novel or if they watch, you know, the latest Star Wars TV, you know, and want to, you know, get more meaning out of it. So I thought it was great. Yeah, Katie, when I was reading the Higher Ed Chronicle article, I was like, yeah, this is our jam.
I know. You're right in there with us, Christine. Like, yeah, that was totally. Definitely, that was
excellent.
Very good. All right. And so now it's time for our special segment. And this time we have some deliveries from Owl Post.
Look up. It's time for Owl Post.
Today we have two letters from listeners to share with you. First, from Matthew. He's catching up with some episodes, and after listening to episode 4, which was our discussion on violence and civilization, he had this to say. In the discussion, I was somewhat surprised no mention was made of the scene in Deathly Hallows where Harry and McGonagall use the unforgivable curses on one of the Karrows. Either of them could have used a stunning spell instead, but chose to other their opponent. I eventually came to accept Harry trying to use the Cruciatus on Bellatrix in Order of the Phoenix, like Hermione's slap punch, an emotional outburst under trying circumstances, but have never liked Harry's choice here. Thanks for all the interesting discussions, Matthew. All right, so let's see what we think about how we would answer this. This is a This is, by the way, a great point.
Yeah, it is a great point. Thanks for the email.
Yeah, I always have. This has always made me very uneasy, this use of unforgivable curses that seem to they mount up, right? Harry has this first attempt to use it against Bellatrix that doesn't really work all that well, I guess. And so, especially since it's not effective, and Matthew said, you know, this is a very fraught moment for him. And
He makes a bad choice.
Yeah.
He makes a bad choice.
And he's a kid. Right. Yeah. But what do we make of this moment when we're, you know, right up at the Battle of Hogwarts toward the end of the novels, toward the end of the whole series, and not only Harry, but McGonagall are using unforgivable curses against the Karrows, who were not good people.
Well, no. There's that. Yeah. So it bothered me too, because I guess when I was initially reading it, I was like, well, hey, I thought these were supposed to be unforgivable, you know, I thought these were the mark of the bad characters, you know? Mm-hmm. But I will say, when Harry uses it in McGonagall's defense, after she gets spat on, I think what we're supposed to take from it is Harry's affection for McGonagall and his respect and concern for McGonagall, sort of in appreciation for all the care that she's given him over the years. So I would say, I don't know quite what we're supposed to do with McGonagall using it, except for, you know, maybe to say, that's it, gloves are off. This is war. You know, the narrative has changed now. And this is the moment, you know, where you can't pull the punches. Although it runs counter to Lupin criticizing Harry for always using Expelliarmus. And Harry kind of doubles down, you know, Lupin tries to say, this is not the time for disarming spells. Either be prepared to kill somebody or, you know, go to a different, nicer war that we're having, you know. Uh-huh. And Harry defends himself and he kind of doubles down and says, you know, no, this is my signature spell. I mean, this is the what we take from the outcome of that. This is his signature spell. And in the end, it works for him. You know, in the end, it gets the job done. So yeah, it kind of does run counter to that.
But
notion.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. But in between there, then he's just using it on Amicus Caro when he maybe doesn't even need to.
Yeah. So that's all I got.
Christine, do you have any thoughts on this?
I was really excited to hear that you had a question about this, because I'm like, oh yeah, I've always been bothered by that too. And I have never been able to come up with an excuse for it. I might have been okay with it if at some point later somebody had said, you know what, we got caught up in the moment, we probably shouldn't have done that, but we never get that moment. And so it's another one of those awkward moments in the narrative where we're like, I'm not sure everybody's quite as good as I want them to be. I mean, these are faulty people. And if that's one thing we've learned from these stories, it's that these people do make mistakes. And we're not used to seeing McGonagall make mistakes, but she really dislikes the Karrows. And I think she kind of gets wrapped up in humiliating them by taking Amicus's ability to resist her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you got to imagine that's been building up after a long year at Hogwarts.
Oh, yeah. Of her watching them torture students. I mean,
well,
just.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what I was going to say. So I do think, like, I totally agree, Christine, like there's no, like the books never invite us to question the use of these curses against the Karrows.
Right.
You know, not to mention the goblin in Gringotts, you know, we're kind of along with the plot and there's not a lot of second guessing and we're not, the text itself is not inviting us to ponder the ethics of it. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, I'm just thinking about Rowling and her personality, you know, I wonder, and I had, Emily, you had this phrase, gloves are off. I had that exact phrase in my notes. The idea that the Karrows have been torturing physically and emotionally these students at Hogwarts, and that McGonagall particularly has been in a position where she has been powerless and has had to watch it, that this is a give as she got, where she has this little moment where she's doing something maybe sort of similar, right? Where he's powerless to act in return, and that we're supposed to feel, a little sort of thrill of satisfaction, that there's a little justice to that, even though like it's the use of an unforgivable curse.
Yeah, not unlike the slap punch.
Right.
Of Hermione against Draco.
Right. And I was thinking also of, you know, and Emily, we've talked about this dilemma before, Hagrid giving Dudley the pig's tail at the beginning.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Or the ferret incident, the ferret with Malfoy. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Rowling has some of these, right, where we get a little revenge and it feels good because it feels like justice, right?
Schadenfreude.
And so I'm just wondering if that's maybe just the, it's not totally satisfying as an interpretation, but that's kind of how I understand why the text is the way it is.
Yeah.
Well, Matthew,
watch out for.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we've given you a satisfactory answer, but we share your concern. So thank you for that great question. Appreciate it. We also got a lovely holiday letter from listener Catherine from Germany, who had this to say: "Dear Katie, dear Emily, and Laurie, and the rest of the podcast team, thank you for all the time you dedicate to your podcast. I love waiting for the new episodes and thinking about them afterwards. Since this will reach you after Christmas, I hope you had a great Christmas with some lovely days with your families and a good start to 2022. Here's to a great new year with lots of good ideas for new podcast episodes. Lots of magical love from Germany, Catherine." Thank you so much for this note and for listening, Catherine, and magical love right back to you.
How lovely. How lovely. And that was a physical postcard, right, Katie?
It sure was. Yes, it was.
Catherine,
that was really nice. Yes. Made my day for sure. For sure.
Dankeschön.
I shared it immediately with the whole, took a photo, shared it with our whole podcast team. So listeners, if you are so inclined to send us challenging, provocative questions, critiques, or compliments, for sure, we would love to hear from you. So please definitely, you know, send us your ideas. Thank you, Christine, so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
This is a great conversation. Emily and I are up for house elves anytime, Christine.
Yes, we are.
Now we are going to end today's episode with two quotations. First, the words of Albus Dumbledore. After the battle at the Ministry of Magic and Order of the Phoenix, during which the Fountain of Magical Brethren was obliterated, a statue that depicted harmonious and hierarchical relationships among magical people, Dumbledore said to Harry, "The fountain we destroyed tonight told a lie. We wizards have mistreated and abused our fellows for too long, and we are now reaping our reward." But I did not want to end with the words of the oppressor. So I thought the inspirational quote from our oppressed but heroic Dobby. He says, "Dobby has no master. Dobby is a free elf."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.